Okay, so now topic 10. The duties of a snataka. A brahmana who is a snataka and subsists by one of the above-mentioned modes of life must discharge the following duties which secure heavenly bliss, long life, and fame. Right, so now he's maintained himself. Now these are his duties. That means as a brahmana, as someone who's graduated, who's been educated, this then are his duties in his lifestyle, right? Because the occupation simply generates facility, right? Then you have to do something with that facility. So what he's doing, that's your duties, right? Okay, now maintaining purity in the performance of occupational duties. Let him untired perform daily the rites prescribed for him in the Veda. For he who performs those according to his ability attains to the highest state. So what one's doing is according to Veda, but according to one's ability. Because the Veda will give many different options of what you can do. And so you pick what you can do. Right? It means there's a hierarchy, of course. It's not that they're necessarily all equal. So within that, you pick whatever works for you, you know, consistently. One can, on occasion, do something that doesn't. You know, like you can chant extra rounds on a festival day or something like that. So you wouldn't necessarily do that daily. So you daily chant what you can, and on an occasion, then you can increase or do other things like that. That's the idea. So it's according to his ability. So that's the point. Whether he be rich or even in distress. Right? So in distress means he's unable to perform his normal duties or things aren't working properly. Let him not seek wealth through pursuits to which men cleave, nor by forbidden occupations, nor let him accept presents from any giver whatsoever he may be. Right, so even if there's a problem, he should then avoid trying to get money through ways that the common man, you know, pursues. Or forbidden occupations, things that are considered sinful, he should avoid those. And still let him not accept presents just from anyone. Right? Someone may give him, so he'll accept it, but he won't keep it for himself. It'll be given to others. Right? So just that they've given, he's accepting. But it wouldn't be part of his occupation and that's what he gained for himself. This would be part of ashram where he's accepting the charity and then immediately giving it away, like that. Does that make sense? Let him not, out of desire for enjoyments, attach himself to any sensual pleasures, and let him carefully obviate an excessive attachment to them by reflecting on their worthlessness in his heart. So this is how one starts to break down material desire, is by contemplating their worthlessness. Because actually, if you do look at it, most things don't have a value. Right? Their value is some particular kind of experience that we feel we'll get, but it's not necessarily that we'll get it. It's not consistent, and even if we have gotten it, we'll find the quality of it is not satisfying to the soul. So by contemplating all these different angles, then we start to see something's worthless. Therefore, we cut down the excessive attachment, right? So excessive is very difficult to deal with because one will perform the activity to get that result no matter what. But once you've cut it down from excessive just to attachment, then one can deal with it according to the rules. So one always is trying to cut down, you know, attachments to more and more workable, to where it's just you have duties, so you perform them. Even though you'll get the result and an experience before you would be working for, now you're doing it because that's your duty. You want to please Krishna. Does that make sense? So same result, same experience will come, but that's not why you're doing it anymore. You're doing it just because it pleases Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? In the beginning, you'll do anything to get that experience. Then you'll do, you know, whatever the Shastra recommends to get the experience. Then you'll just do what Shastra recommends that you should do as your duty, and the experience just comes on the side. Does that make sense? Because then you're doing it to please Krishna. Or from detachment, then you could say the next step would be do that to please Krishna. But for us, it's easier to do them both at once. You're doing it for Krishna, therefore it breaks down that attachment. You can do it as naishkarmya. Does that make sense? Yeah. Let him avoid all means of acquiring wealth which impede the study of the Veda. Let him maintain himself anyhow, but study, because that devotion of the Veda study secures the realization of his aims. Right? So Prabhupada said, read the books. So here, now when we were discussing before about occupation, how to do it, so he's saying is, even if it means, you know, you're going to get your, maintain yourself by whatever, make sure you study. So if it comes down to, I can do a better occupation but not study, or I can do an occupation that's not as great, but I can study, then pick the study, right? Because the study will actually gain, give you the understanding and realization, while the occupation simply gives you wealth, right? The idea is that a pure occupation creates a pure environment in which you can understand things. But just because the environment's pure doesn't mean that you'll necessarily have the realization. Because if that was the environment, all the animals would be realized, right? Because they live in the purest environment, right? They live out in the forest where everything's controlled by the laws of nature. There's nothing happening there that's not according to law. No one's breaking the law. So it's the purest environment, you could say, right? In the mode of goodness. But they're not getting realization. So, but because they don't have the knowledge. So the knowledge is more important than the pure environment. Right, but you always strive for the pure environment in which then that knowledge that you studied can be applied. You understand? So there's always this balance. So we shouldn't then go to the point, oh, so then the pure environment doesn't matter, you know, so then I'll work down at the strip club and, you know, but I'll study, you know. I'll be sitting there in the back room, you know, reading my books and like that. Girls are coming and going, hey, but, you know, I'm studying, you know. You know, so it's not, we don't use... We means we should always avoid these extreme approaches, right? Because the tendency is, oh, if there's even the smallest little hole, then immediately we break it open into a, you know, from a drop to a river, and then, you know, and then it's okay. No, there's a difference. The Vedas are always making discrimination that we can tell fine differences, right? Does that make sense? You, just for fun, you want to hear a fine difference that we're talking about? Okay, now we know that there's perception, right, pratyaksha. There's inference and there's shabda, or the word. There's authority, right? So these are the three that we accept as ways of gaining knowledge. There's actually about 10 different ways, but... For us, these three are main because they contain all the others, so we don't get distracted by these others. So now, so we'll say that inference means inference, you're looking at something, and by looking at it, you get an understanding of something you can't see, right? Like you see how the person's dressed, and then you think, wow, they must, you know, they must be a businessman. You can't see that they're a businessman, but by dealing with what you can see, you infer that they're a businessman, right? So something perceived is therefore you understand something not perceived. Okay? Straightforward, right? And verbal testimony means you're hearing from authority, hearing from Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So it all has to be based back on the Shastra. It has to be based on the Veda. That something... From that word, then you can see something that you don't know about, right? Like no one's seen the Uttara Kurus, right? Does that make sense? But we know from Shastra that it's there. So through something perceivable, right, the word, we therefore understand something that's not perceivable, okay? Now, the difference between... Now The Buddhists and others, they will say, because they're trying to establish that there is nothing real here, they will say that there's no difference between the two. Right? Verbal testimony and inference are the same. because you're taking something known, and by observing it, understanding something that's unknown, right? So one is a word, and one is you've through the senses, so what's the difference? Understand? So it's very subtle here. But the point is the one is coming from your perception. And so you may make an interpretation, while the word is coming from authority, who is not fallible. It's not based on their senses, it's based on the Veda. And it's based on them being in the liberated platform. They don't make the mistake. So even though it seems the process of going from something perceived to something unperceived, they're still completely different because one's based on authority and one's just your opinion about how you perceive something. Though it may be correct, but it's still subject to your interpretation. You understand? So that is what the Veda is talking about, you know, when we're trying to understand these fine points. They look very similar. Does that make sense? They look very similar. But, how you say? But they're not. So in these things, when we come up with these, is that therefore, let him not get in the way of his study and his practices. So better you take up occupations that doesn't give you as much facility, or maybe it's not quite as ideal, but it gives you the time to study and practice. But that means, it says before, is that... Where is it? That was one before. It was saying that it was about Ritta. One who follows this path, then he must perform sacrifice. So the point is you're studying, you must be trying to apply it. Not that you sit around and study all day and do nothing with it, right? Because the Veda is trying to establish that you're always active, right? But you're giving up material action and you're taking up spiritual action. But action is what must be performed. Does that make sense? We relate to it because there's material action, so I stop all that. And then there's spiritual action. But actually what you're doing is just not doing material and taking up spiritual. But because of our tendency towards gyan, right, and karma and gyan, therefore, I don't want this result of this activity, therefore I won't do it. Rather than action must be performed, therefore I'll perform transcendental, because that will give spiritual result rather than material. You understand? That's the point, the subtle difference makes for an understanding of the Shastra, right? It's these things are important. So this is the kind of intelligence we're looking for, to be able to discriminate just because the word is common, right? But the thing is they're used differently, right? To continue that previous argument a touch further, then the objector might come back and say, okay, you know, but the word, you're going from... You're seeing something, and that signifies, perceiving something that signifies something that's unperceived. And the word is signifying something that is unperceived. So therefore, they're still the same. Right? Even it's come from authority, but the method is exactly the same. But then Gotama will say, no, but the word, even though you say it represents, it depends who's saying the word. Right? You know, the Yavanas have one use of the word, the Rishis have another, and someone who follows the Vedic literature is another. Right? So, therefore, in one sense, the Rishis will look at it, what takes you out of the material world, the same word. The Aryan will see what will be the pious result from performing it, and the Mleccha has a completely different, you know, sinful understanding. So the word, even though it represents, it's not directly connected, right? I see smoke on a mountain, right? So then I say there's fire on the mountain, right? Because fire and smoke go together. But fire and smoke are directly and naturally connected, right? But let's say I'm using the word cow, right? So then cow is, how do you say, not naturally connected with the word. If I say cow, there is no cow here. You understand? So words aren't directly connected, right? That's the thing about spiritual. Krishna's name are non-different. That's why the point is made so strongly, because in the material world, the word and its object aren't connected, right? There's a logic to it. The syllables have the meaning of what that object does, but it's not that they're non-different, right? But seeing the smoke on the mountain, you know there's fire, because fire and smoke are directly connected, but the word and the object aren't. Right, so therefore we can't say, see, again, there's difference. We can't say, so inference is going from something that's not connected, but perceiving the unperceivable. And the other is you're going from something that's directly perceivable through the senses, and then coming to the unperceived. Right? Because one is starting from authority, one is actually starting from the sensual perception. But both of them come up with giving you what's unseen. But they're still completely different. You catch this? Right? So these are the kind of things we have to be able to discern, is just because the modern uses the word in one way doesn't mean that that is the way the word is used. Because they'll take it that this is authority. Right? We're saying Shastra's authority. And they're saying my mentor is an authority. Or my seat is an authority. Or my college is an authority. Or my academy is an authority. What we're saying is they're not saintly persons. Therefore, their word is different from the word of the scripture. So you can't equate them. Right? What the professor says, what the scientist says, and it said there, a million persons unqualified, or who don't know the Veda, don't equal one person who does. So therefore, there aren't, I don't think, a million professors in that field who would agree in a conclusion that goes against the Vedas. So that means you don't even have enough people to even get close to equaling one person who does. You understand? So even in here, then you split it, because they're using the power of their words. But their words only actually have power in how much they signify what's there, and based on the significance of the understanding or the direction of authority. Does that make sense? So therefore, modern words and modern perceptions don't actually have any value, because what they're saying and what they're talking about don't connect, either by words or by action. Well, the Vedas, then they're using the word in the proper way as God had given it to be used. And at the same time, the process actually connects. In a sense. So there's a vast difference here. But by these subtleties that the Shastra gives, then it makes it very easy to define. So that's why in here, we're not catching on the gross meanings of the words. We're catching on the import, or what they're implying here. Yes.
Please define saintly person.
Saintly person. Okay. It would be someone who would be practicing a process given by the Vedas in line with in the parampara of the Vedas. Yeah, I would say like that. You know, but someone who's learning from there and sincerely practicing, then you'd say this is a saintly person. So that would also give rise to a broad range. So that means anybody who is taking it up. So even the neophyte would be saintly. Now we could say within this, there's more saintliness in a Madhyama than in a neophyte. There's more in the Uttama than the Madhyam, like this. But saintliness is common there. So that means, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, yes.
It seems like Srila Prabhupada imported some words from the World Dictionary and gave them his own meaning, like reincarnation. It has a different meaning in Latin, but Prabhupada gave it its own meaning in the form of avatar. So it's today. There are many words which are imported but their meaning is changing.
It could be, but probably if you look back to the original Roman or Greek, it's probably how Prabhupada uses it is closer. Like psychology means the knowledge of the soul. But nowadays, it's the soul is left out of it. It's only the mind. So psychology will mean knowledge of the soul that you're approaching through its perception by the mind. You know, because the mind, then you can see the senses. So you can see what someone does, but you're actually trying to get to the soul. So originally, the Greek thinkers, that was the meaning. But nowadays, it doesn't have that. So when we say psychology, then we're actually closer to the real meaning of the word. So much of the time, you'll see how Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur use it is extremely exact. You know, it's exact to the point where some would consider the usage archaic. But because it's being used now, then it becomes the contemporary term. I would tend that they will use the words exactly. See, because one has to understand is that Prabhupada and the Acharyas, they know Sanskrit. You know, not just as an academically learned subject, but as their own language. They'll think in Sanskrit, right? So therefore, they know how the words work from their roots, and how they grammatically combine. So when Prabhupada uses the language, you know, like English, he's using it according to Sanskrit grammar, but applying it how modern usage would basically appreciate it. Right, so just like on my desk, we'll see a word. We'll see a sentence that we will say is okay English, but not great English. Right, this is, you know, you have that little like calendar thing. It's all quotes from Prabhupada on what he said on that day. So there's one on the desk. It says, when a man sees, what is this? Yeah, when a man sees the breast of a young woman and this armpit, then he's finished, right? So as long as he's charmed by these things, he'll take birth again and again, right? So we'll just take it, he's kind of put these words together. But if you look at it, it's very exact because he says the breast. So it doesn't matter what form it's in. You know, which way it's observed, how it is, presented or not. It's just the breast. But he says this armpit, because that's specific. He didn't say the armpit. He said this armpit. You know what I'm saying? Because it's very specific, because the Shastra defines, mudra, you know, the different bodily form, movements express a certain mood, okay? So it doesn't mean armpit is like, you know, sitting like this and you see the armpit. It means this. You understand? So this armpit, the breast, this armpit. You understand? Because that signifies a mood of openness. Does that make sense? So that means then one's attracted by the breast and there's an opportunity. You understand? So it's very exact, but unless you know the Vedic sciences and all that, you wouldn't know that that's what Prabhupada is talking about. You just think he's using kind of English in a weird way because he went to school, you know, 100 years ago and learned from, you know, Scottish priests. And so, you know, they're Scotsmen, not Englishmen. And so they have their own weird way of using language. You understand? But no, him and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, when they use their English, it is so exact. It means what they're talking about. You understand? So we should always be careful about that, because otherwise we in our contemporaneous say, well, this word would have been better, but it's not necessarily. If Prabhupada used it, all you're trying to do is put it together how people will say it's not grammatically wrong by adding an and in or shifting a little something, but does that make sense? because they know language, so they know how to communicate. So they're saying exactly what they want to say. It's not that Prabhupada's just kind of giving some idea. He's not like this, you know, Mayor Baba or something, and, you know, it's all wonderful and nice, and, you know, they don't know what it means. They're just saying it. There's a feeling. No, they can exactly say. Does that make sense? No, but they're just using the definitions that are the actual definitions. It's not that he's given. That's what it means in Sanskrit, right? So the point is that's what it actually means. And much of the time you'll see is there is, at some point in time, a usage or one of many of the usages that actually mean that. So we're saying it means this definition. Well, most people may use it from another definition. You know what I'm saying? Like you say something's cool. We don't mean its temperature is low. You know, we mean it's socially appreciated because it's something fresh, you know, and fresh with a particular reserved power, right? So, but it also does mean temperature. You know, so Prabhupada will use the words in a specific way and he'll always use them in that way. It's not that one time he uses them this way and one time he doesn't. They're always used in the same way. So once that's appreciated, then it's always there. So I would take this beyond that. It's that he may have put together, now you could say he's created super soul. That won't be an English word, but super is and soul is. So he's taken the meaning of super, meaning greater than or beyond, you know, uber, you know, something great beyond ordinary. And then you have the soul. So super soul is what's beyond the soul. So he'll do things like that. But I don't see that he changes the meanings. You know what I'm saying? Love means where there's actually that sense of sacrifice that is based on not getting something in return. Right? So people will say that's what love was mean, but if you dig deeply into what they're doing, there is something for themselves. Like that. But on the surface, at least, it looks like love, so we have something to talk about. Because the materialist only goes so deep. So therefore, that's where you start. And as you increase his understanding, it'll actually increase his understanding of the word love. But it's not that it's a different meaning. Right? In other words, there is only Krishna consciousness. Lack of Krishna consciousness creates everything else. Does that make sense? Right? There is only theism, but lack of it is atheism. Right? It doesn't have its own word. Does that make sense? Is that okay? Yeah, so I'm just saying is we always be careful, otherwise we just take Prabhupada as an Indian gentleman who, you know, used English to the best of his ability to explain such high levels of understanding and concepts as are in the Vedic literatures and languages. But the point is he knows language, so therefore he can use English to express what he wants to express. Though in Sanskrit you have one nice term that does it, you have to use a whole phrase, you know, or even a sentence in English to get the point across. But they know how to exactly get the point across. That's why when you read it, it gets more and more understanding. Like you read the Gita once, and then, you know, after a couple of years, you read it again, you see more meanings that you didn't see before, but the words are the same. So one is the chit potency is there, that's why you get the realization. But two, his exactness of the words is very, very, you know, exemplary. So it becomes deeper and deeper. Does that make sense? You know? So, you know, and then it's just a matter of adjusting it to make it so that the contemporary usage can appreciate it. But the point is it doesn't even have to get to that. If it's appreciated how great is the presentation, it becomes its own language. Right? Does anybody try to grammatically correct Shakespeare? No. But as far as contemporary English was, from the time it was written till today, it's not correct in so many ways. But because it was so poetic and so much expressed what was wanted to be expressed, even though he did it in a very unorthodox way, people just accepted it. So now it's even, there are people who, you know, basically study his grammar and, you know, have understood or created their own Shakespearean grammar, you know. Does that make sense? So like that. So, like, yes.
That is also what I wanted to fix yesterday when we were talking about experiences and memories, because the words also carry some kind of experience. Like, for instance, theology nowadays, it means like we are discussing whether there is God or not. But it's not the theology doesn't mean that. It means the science of God. So
yeah. Means there it would be more, that would be more, I think, ontology or epistemology or something like that. But they can't distinguish because they don't know. That's the, yes, yes. So you get it. Is that okay? Okay. Let him walk here on earth, bringing his dress, speech, and thoughts to a conformity with his age, his occupation, his wealth, his sacred learning, and his race. Right? No, it's family heritage. So in other words, one should be consistent in all these things. It means, in other words, socially, culturally consistent. Right? The person's really old, he doesn't dress like he's, you know, 20, you know. So like that, how he speaks, it should be there. You know, if the young people speak all kinds of this, you know, weird street talk, you know, it just sounds normal. But when you see someone who's, you know, 60 years old, wow, awesome. You know, it's kind of like, huh? It's like, you know, hey, get with it, gramps. You know, it's like, you know, just it. So it, all these things should be in conformity. So his age, his occupation, his wealth, his learning, his, you know, what would be the heritage of that line. Does that make sense? So there should be a balance. So otherwise, one ends up with a mix. If there's a conformity, then people will always feel it's nice. You know what I'm saying? It may not be flashy, it may not be fancy, but it will be nice. So if the dhoti is worn, you know, what shoes and socks match that, whatever shirt you wear matches that, the hat and coat you wear match that. They all go together as, if you're going out in a dhoti, so therefore someone who is dressed as a devotee or a priest or this or that, or if you're wearing karmic clothes, that they actually match and they signify who you are, right? So if you're an elder gentleman, does one go out with a dog chain, right? No. So these different things, is one is very careful about them. Then people respect that you know how to dress. So when devotees talk about, you know, oh, the Vedic dress, and people won't accept it, anything to not appreciate is simply because it's not in conformity with the person and who they're representing. But at the same time, as the same people, if they wear karmic clothes, also don't represent what's in conformity with who they are. You know what I'm saying? So that's why you see someone on the street, he's wearing his suit, it all matches, but it's not something you would call fashionable, but you'll accept that this here's a properly dressed gentleman, right? Nothing flashy, but it's proper according to his mood, what you see him doing, therefore he's dressed. But people will accept him as a gentleman. You know, he won't be fancy, you know, he's not wearing, you know, the black suit, you know, the black shirt with the black tie and the black, you know, black on black and doing all these different things, you know, so, but it works. Does that make sense? So that is very important element, is that it should be consistent throughout. So the thing that devotees don't dress properly, that's, we'll say, oh, well, that's Vedic. No, it's not. That's modern. Vedic is you have to dress according to your age, your mentality, your occupation, your wealth, your position, everything like that. That's how you dress. Then it looks, it's consistent. Right? Does that make sense? Then no one bothers. Like, let's say, you know the term frumpy? Frumpy? Frumpy is like not dressed so well, things aren't so well matched, and they're not so nicely worn, and they tend to be a little bit, probably a little bit shabby, a little old, right? Now, if someone dresses and they look frumpy, it doesn't look good. But now if someone who's like an absent-minded professor dresses like a frump, it matches. Like Einstein, you know, he doesn't comb his hair, he's got his suit on, but he's got on house slippers. It perfectly matches. You know what I'm saying? No one will say, you know, if he, you know, you had him out there in a Versace suit like that, his hair done up like that, and some nice shiny, you know, size 12 shoes or something, you'd say, who's that? You know? You understand? But it matches. So that's the point, is this, even the devotional clothes worn not so attractively, if it matches the nature of the person, that they're not worried about what looks attractive. They're just worried about devotional service. Everyone will accept them how they are. How were the devotees accepted in the 60s and 70s? So easily. Because how they dressed was how they thought, was how it was consistent. You know, but as we try to fit in, how do we fit in? You know what I'm saying? We're Orthodox religious people. How do we fit in? You know, what does that mean? You know, do we look like the Hispanics out on the street? You know, do we look like, you know, we just came out of Rodeo Drive? You know, how are we supposed to dress?
Devotional.
But I'm just saying, even if it was karma, what would be the dress? What is that fitting in that we're talking about? So that's the thing, is they can't even define. So you get all this mix of stuff and all this and that. And, you know, it's like, you know, but they just wear the, how you say, the kind of like, you know, not enough pleats, gypsy skirt with a super baggy T-shirt. And then at the same thing, so they look like a total slob. And then at the same time, is there a Prabhupada disciple, and I'm the senior person here, and I should be saying how things should be run. And it's kind of like, how does all this match? Yes.
Maybe to fit in is that you dress like that nobody recognizes that you're a devotee when you go to a restaurant or cinema.
True. But the amazing thing is people always know a devotee. They always know. It's rare that someone could dress and you wouldn't know. But those are the ones that know how to dress nicely. So then you'll think he's a gentleman. But the other ones, they just don't fit in. You know, they're not quite, you know, they didn't quite, you know, they didn't quite gel, you know. Because no karmis dress the way we dress. And they say, oh, but it's the long skirt. No, I mean, looking out the window, it's like a quarter, no, maybe a fifth, 20% of the ladies that walk by have long skirts. And those are karmis. Those aren't devotees. I know when I was in the airport, even more than that was wearing long skirts. You know, all the way down to the ground. And they're just karmis. You know, it's just one of the fashionable things. You just have to know how to pull it off. You know what I'm saying? So it's not that there's any restriction, because the men, it's not a difficulty. There's some variety of pants and shirt or something like that. You just have to have something that matches and something that looks decent. So women more who complain. But it's like women can wear anything. You know, you could go out in a potato sack and somebody be, wow, check it out. You know? Does that make sense? Let him daily pore over those institutes of science which soon give increase of wisdom, those which teach the acquisition of wealth, those which are beneficial for the worldly concerns, and likewise over the nigamas which explain the Veda. All right. So he should study those things that quickly give the wisdom, means those the direct sciences, means the transcendental, like Bhagavatam, Gita, the Upanishads, you know, the devotional literatures. That would be the most important. Then other aspects that one needs to understand the Vedas and understands how to apply into the worldly environment, like this. Manu is one of those. You know, what brings about the worldly concerns, wealth, these other aspects like that. For the more a man completely studies the institutes of science, the more he fully understands them, and his great learning shines brightly. Let him never, as he able to perform them, neglect the sacrifices to the sages, to the gods, to the Buddhas, to the men, and to the mains. So in other words, if he's able to do devotional service, let him not neglect it. Some men who know the ordinances for sacrificial rites always offer these great sacrifices in their organs of sensation without any external effort. Knowing that the performance of the sacrifice in their speech and their breath yields imperishable rewards. So here, even here, he's now concluding this with, there are those sages who do this because of their knowledge. So they don't actually perform the rituals, but they perform the purpose of the rituals. Other brahmanas, seeing with the eye of knowledge that the performance of those rites has knowledge for its root, always perform them through knowledge alone. Right? So you have those who perform the ritual, those who contemplate the purposes of the ritual, and those then who understand the transcendence as the base, then are always engaged in that way. Does that make sense? Yeah. Receiving guests. So, okay. So this is different from the titi, you know, and how to deal with the guest. Now this is another aspect. No guest must stay in his house without being honored according to his ability, with a seat, food, a couch, water, or roots or fruits, right? So that's been said a second time. So according to Mimamsa, then anything repeated means it's important. So this is the second time we've heard basically this exact. All it said was water, roots, and fruits. That means because anyone can get roots and fruits, right? Let him not honor, even by speech, imposters, men who follow forbidden occupations, men who live like cats, rogues, logicians, arguing against the Veda, and those who live like herons. Right? So he should never honor, even just by speech, those who are, you know, improper in their occupation or behavior, understand? In other words, those who are bogus, they shouldn't be. So then... Okay, so let him honor, not honor even by speech. So here it mentions one may feed them but not host them, right? So one might distribute food like that because you don't discriminate there, but one wouldn't take them into the house and give them that seat of honor and, you know, do things to please them. Okay, who live like cats? Those who perform religious duties to gain facility and respect, not because such rites are their prescribed duties, right? So that's the lifestyle of a cat, because you'll see this come up later. It's always referred to. So when it says the cat, it's not just arbitrary. You know, just like when we say camels, we mean those who drink their own blood for their own sense gratification, right? The camels, they eat the thorns, it cuts the tongue. They think it's the thorns that are nice tasting when it's their own blood. So it's their own effort, their own work, their own energy, that itself is what they're experiencing, right? Like that. Does that make sense? Okay. So here, cats means that. They perform religious duties to gain facility and respect. They're not doing it because they're supposed to. They're doing it simply because it'll get me the... It may be their duty, but they're not doing it because it is their duty. They're doing it because if I do this, I'll get wealth, I'll get respect. So that's a cat. Yes.
How do you practice recognize these persons? I mean, they don't come in the door and say, I'm like a cat and I'm doing this and this. And
that's why then you must look for that, what is behind it. So that's where then the element of, that's where inference comes in. You see, he's doing these things as his duty, but he's proud, you know, or he's very interested in position because he says here, what did he say? Facility and respect. So he's too attached to the facility he'll get from it or the respect that he'll get from it. Because if it was duty, he wouldn't be. So if that's too much there, then is he just attached to these things, though he's doing this duty because he's supposed to, or is he doing the duty simply for these things? So one keeps one's eye out and then starts to notice.
That's with somebody whom you have experienced already. before, or you heard about him?
No, not necessarily, just by watching what... That is by if you know that it's there, then you can recognize it. You know what I'm saying? If you don't know the difference, then but if you know that there's difference, then you start to see the difference. Right? There's a difference between someone who an attitude or someone who performs his prescribed duty because he's supposed to, and someone who's performing it simply because it will get him the results. And especially if you see, is let's say it's a duty that should be, let's say, brahminical, but he doesn't have a brahminical nature, but he's performing it to get facility and respect. Let's say you're doing an abhishek. Now, whose occupation is that? Brahmin. But he's not. He's a vaishya, right? Now, he'll come up and try to make a big show out of how he's so devotionally bathing the deity and all that and so many things. And you know what I'm saying? You know, he doesn't pick up the conch shell. He has to take it up and, you know, pour on the feet and then pour on the head and do all these things. But you don't need all that attitude to appreciate the deity. You know what I'm saying? So you know something's wrong there. Because Brahmins don't do that. It's their occupation. They come up and do this. You know what I'm saying? Like the businessman, he doesn't sit there, get out the money, and he counts it, and he gives it to you, and takes it back just in case, counts it again that he didn't give you the money, and he gives it. No, he just money and gives you the money, because that's what he does all day. So you can start to see symptoms that something's wrong here. Does that make sense? So if you're aware of it, then you can see it. But at the same time, as we're not aware of it to find fault. We're aware of it to avoid fault. Right? That's why these things aren't brought out too strongly, because then people will find fault. Right? And when there's no need to. Is that okay? Yeah. Okay. A man who ever covetous, you know, in other words, he's envious, like that, displays the flag of virtue, who is a hypocrite, a deceiver of the people, intent on doing injury, and a detractor from the merits of all men. He's critical. One must know to be one who acts like a cat. So that's another. So that gives more detail on how to understand the cat. So these are from two. That's 4:1. This is the same later in the same chapter. Men who live like herons. That Brahmin who, with downcast look, of a cruel disposition, is solely intent on attaining his own ends, dishonest and falsely gentle, is one who acts like a heron. Right? So you can see these symptoms, yes. Yeah, I mean, these things would apply. So therefore, anybody who has these natures, you'd be a little careful of. You know, let them continue chanting a few years, it'll go away. But at the present time when it's there, be more careful.
So one doesn't associate so closely, actually?
One is very careful. One doesn't become close with these people because there is no benefit to it. Right? It means there may be material benefit for them, but there'll be no spiritual because they'll take advantage. And there'll be no benefit spiritually or materially for you. So therefore, one you know, if one bumps in, one's pleasant, but one doesn't interact. Does that make sense? You know, one is not stiff, but one is not, doesn't get involved. Those who have become snatikas after studying the Veda or after completing their vows, and householders who are Kshatriyas, one must worship by gifts of food sacred to gods and manes, but one must avoid those who are otherwise. Right? So the snatikas, because you have snatikas, means you have a snatika can mean a graduated grihastha brahmin, you know, like that. It can also, but at the same time as here we say Kshatriyas. So that would mean someone who is knowledgeable and realized. Because it also can, in this case, mean snataka, mean he's graduated but has not yet married. Because there is that time when, after graduation, he wants to further his study but the study he wants is no longer with the ashram where he was, that teacher. There's another teacher that'll have some other branch of knowledge he wants to know. But he's done his Vedic study, he's done his training. So now that where he goes now, they don't have to train him in how to be a brahmachari. It's just a matter of the specific knowledge. So he may travel or he may go see all the places of pilgrimage, right? Because he'll have done that, because once you get married, settled down, you may not be able to do that until vanapras. So he does that before he gets married. So that's why it's very often that a snataka would be an atiti, because they'd always be traveling, going to holy places and things like that. Does that make sense? But at the same time, it also means the householder who there is a Kshatriya, who is someone who's fixed and is nicely engaged in his duties and understands the scriptures. So these three means the snataka who's finished his study or the snataka who's finished his vow. Does that make sense? Let's say you have a vow to stay in the Gurukul for 12 years. Now you should finish study of at least one Veda. But he doesn't finish the Veda, but he finished the 12 years. So he finished his vow, so now he graduates. Or the other one is, I will study the Veda, one Veda. But instead of doing it 12 years, he does it in 8. So he graduates, right? So best is one who finishes his vow and his study. So he's finished the 12 years and finished the Veda. That would be considered better. But it can be either one, right? Because some persons are, the ashram element of it is very, their behavior, their service attitude, that's very outstanding. But they're not like a great scholars. And someone else is their scholarliness, that's what's outstanding, right? But, they do everything properly. So either one of these kind of snatakas and a Kshatriya who's, founded in. Right? Yes.
Some question, because it is said that Brahman is so honest that he discloses the truth even to an animal. Let us say there's some envious person who's attacking him, like even
so one doesn't. He discloses the truth even to an enemy, but it doesn't mean the truth that he discloses would be bad for him or can be used badly against him. You know what I'm saying? If you're not involved in the world, then it doesn't really matter. Right? Does that make sense? Because it doesn't matter what happens in the environment. It's not going to bother your, chanting and stuff. But if one's a householder and things like that, one has responsibilities, then one would be careful that what one says is not going to impact on that situation. In other words, you're not telling a lie, but you're not telling maybe how much truth they're looking for. Because truth means it's connected to the Lord. It's beneficial in the devotional process. So what the other person's looking for is not actually truth. They're looking for a lie, which means material facts that they can use for their political, purposes. So that's not truth. So therefore, you're speaking the truth. It won't be used as truth. So therefore, you speak what is only how much needs to be said in that situation to get done whatever needs to get done. And one doesn't deal more. And they can turn anything like that. I mean, have you ever seen book reviews? On the backs of books, it says, like that. Great. Never seen anything like it before. Great, .. Never seen anything like it before. The sun. Like that. But if, the original was, this is the greatest piece of garbage I've ever seen. I've never seen anything written like this before. And then they cut it out and then make it into, what I'm saying? So that's the point. They can do anything with what you have. So you don't. That's why the more you know, the less they can do these things to you. Like that. That's why, Dharma is what's actually the standard, right? And so, we'll go through this and then slowly we'll get to Artha and Niti and then these things. Then you know how to avoid even on the smallest little thing, just they're saying this and how you can counter and stuff like that. Does that make sense? But that only has meaning if you understand this. You know the standard, because that's a technique, but unless you know the standard, it doesn't mean anything. Is that okay? Yeah. And it says here, one must worship by gifts of food sacred to gods and manes, which means high-grade offering. Right? It doesn't mean opulent. It means that the quality of the offering and the purity and that standard. Right? A householder must give as much food as he is able to spare to those who do not cook for themselves, and to all beings one must distribute without detriment to one's own interest. Right? So here you have that he must as much as he can, but not that it's detrimental. Because that will come up, I think, also in the ninth chapter about charity. Is that someone who gives so much charity, but then his own family doesn't have anything, that's not real charity. Right? Because then there must be something for prestige, or he's thinking of something else in the future, something like that. Point is he takes care of the family and gives the excess in charity. Right? So you have to be very honest with yourself, what is excess and what is necessary. Right? Because otherwise, you know, people own the world and it's still not enough. Right? Does that make sense? Bali Maharaj is on Sutala. It's a big enough planet. Right? But it's not enough. He has to have Indra's planet. You understand? So you'll always get that. So for them, you know, nothing's in excess. If he had the whole universe and then could catch a few more on the side, that would be great. You know, but does that make sense? Yeah. So it's yes.
Sometimes devotees who bring the time to go out, they say, first I have to establish myself materially, and then I can support. So they say, my plan is to build myself a house and a stable position, and then I will give support and build a temple or something. But it ends up that...
Yeah, no, that's it never works. It never will, because you never establish yourself. The point is, someone who's charitably disposed can give money today. If you want to know an interesting fact, you know who gives the most money? You know, besides really stinking rich people, is poor people. If I've gone to house programs, the poorer the person, the bigger the donation. I've gone to these ones where it's all these, you know, so many people, they have their own businesses and that, and, you know, they give me $20. But I'll go to an area of town where you're scared to go there. You know, because everybody is big and they got their chains and they're, you know, walking around and stuff like that. You go to their house, there's hardly any furniture in the house, and they give you $100. Why? Because they appreciate it. The other ones are still too absorbed in their money, and this is not, we got to get this, we got to get that. It'll never come. The point is, if you can give in charity, you can give in charity today. Maybe it's not much. I can only give, what I'm doing now, I can give you $10. Right, you know, and then as it grows in that, you know, my ideas, I'll give you, you know, a 500 or a 1,000 like this a month. But right now, I can only give 10. But they can give. But if they say no, I'm going to do this and that and all these things, just by saying that, they're fools, because they think by saying it, they've accomplished it. But they've done nothing. The point is, charity is always part of the duty. Like that. Because the point is if that's the whole point, then they would drive around in their Trabant, they would wear their old clothes, and they would eat just as simply as they are now. But if you visit their house, let's say after a year or two, their car is better, their clothes are better, their food is better. You know, the kids' toys are better, their gizmos and gadgets are better. But they still haven't established. But if you say, so, what about the don't know, but the house and the business, then all that money that went into these things could have gone to the temple. You know what I'm saying?
They say, I have no money, I have all
this. They have no money, he said, as he has his, you know, just bought his, you know, 24-inch, you know, iMac.
It's on credit and everything.
So what? So he can give to the temple on credit. You know what I'm saying? So the point is that we're not saying that there's a lot. The point is that charity is part of your obligation as a human being, as a householder. You have to give in charity. So therefore, it's part of your sadhana. So that's why you should be giving. So even if it's a small amount, find something and on a regular basis, give something. But my point is it's all on credit, but they are paying for it. It's not that, if you buy it on credit, is it cheaper or more expensive than if you bought it with cash? Yeah, so they're paying more. So better buy things by cash and that difference, give that to the temple if need be. Right? You know, so okay, you have to wait a year to get your iMac. But the point is that after a year, it'll be better anyway. They'll work out the bugs and it'll be a higher thing and it'll cost less. Plus, you know, so it's the point is they can't control their senses. They have to have everything now. Well, actually, now would be not representative. Yesterday would be a better thing like that. Does that make sense? So that's the point is that, but how do you see? Now, just take an example. Okay, you have so many people in the city, right? The local people, Finns, okay, here in the city. How many of them actually own things, right? In proportion to how many Finns are in Helsinki, how many of those Finns own their property that they're living on? Okay? Now, compare that to the statistic of Indians or Asians that have been here for a certain amount of time, let's say like 5 years, and the proportion of how many of them are and how many of them own their properties, you'll probably find it's much greater. Why? Because they'll come in, find the cheapest place, live in the cheapest place, eat simple food, dress simple and all that, and they'll do that for 5 years, they never hear about them. And then one day, suddenly they're in that four-bedroom house with a BMW and a Mercedes in the driveway. Because they didn't spend any money on anything else. They just did their work, worked hard, invested and did all that, and bang, they have it. You know what I'm saying? So that's just the way it is. We have these simple village boys, Bengali boys. They go to the West, you know, we criticize them, they go to the West. Oh, they just come to the West to make money. Well, you know, that's not the reason the Westerners are in the West, right? You know, like that, you know. So then move to Mayapur, then you don't have to worry about making money. No, but how do you maintain yourself? So it's the same thing. So I know that they own houses in the West, they stay in them, and they bought land and are building a house in Mayapur. So it's practically speaking, how you say? The Westerners, they rent. And the Bengalis, they own. Why? Because they know how to use their money. You understand? So this idea is that, like you say, is that we'll do this, and when I have my multinational empire and all that, you know, then I'll sponsor prashad on Prabhupada's Vyas Puja. So they say it's not valid. You can give charity, you can give now, even if it's $5, give now. So you have to train them that they have to give, even if it's small amount, but give on a regular basis. And even if they say, well, the temple, I don't want to give to the temple, then give to somebody in ISKCON. There's traveling preachers, there's these coming through, there's projects, give to somebody. Because otherwise, if you don't give, you yourself will be a miser, and that won't be good for your spiritual development. Right? And just that you say like that, then they'll also appreciate that you're not saying all this to get money for yourself. So there's even a better chance they'll give you some money. Does that make sense? Yes.
Did I get it right that if one who has no money has decided to take a loan, let's say for a new apartment, then it would be wise to get that loan bigger than you actually need just to have money to donate?
That you could also do. You could also do that. Take a bigger loan. And that way then you can give that money. Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you're smart, you would do that. You know, yeah. Okay. Begging. A snatago pines with hunger may beg wealth of a king, of one for whom he sacrifices, and of a pupil, but not of others. That is the settled rule. Right. So this is means if in need, right? So may beg. So if his daily occupation of begging from righteous houses fails, right? Because this will come up in detail later in the 10th chapter where you can't perform your duties. So if his regular occupation of just begging from the local righteous people doesn't work, then he could beg from a king for the person he's doing a yajna for, you know, some kind of sacrifice for, or from a pupil. Otherwise, then he won't, right? Then this still stays within his duties. In other words, this is what you can do that still stays within your duties, right? Like that 10th chapter will describe what you would do if you can't do your duties. A snataka who is able to procure food shall never waste himself with hunger, nor shall he wear old or dirty clothes if he possesses property. Right? So if you have money, then dress according to your money. Right? It doesn't mean you have to be flashy, but it just means you have money. Don't look like a slob. Don't eat like this. You know, not eat food enough or healthy enough. In other words, money is there for a purpose. That's why it's there, is to do these things, to create the facility. So if you have money and don't use it, you know, as facility, that means then it's as good as not having the money. So you're stupid that you're working for it and having it, because you as good as don't have it, right? Does that make sense? Niti is, that's one of the rules of niti. Because if he's miserly with himself, there's a chance he'll be miserly in charity, right? But if you're not miserly with yourself, you know, because of this rule, then you also will give to others. You have money, so you spend for yourself. You have money, you spend for others. Like that. It's a principle. Is that energy is used, right? There's energy, there's a situation, there's activity done with it, right? So there's a situation. You see what you can do in that situation as service for Krishna. Does that make sense? That's the whole idea. So you see a situation, you contemplate what service I could do in this situation, and then you perform the activity for Krishna's pleasure. So activity or service is what one is always striving for. So if you have money and don't engage it, then that means activity is not performed. So that means you won't take care of yourself, you won't take care of your dependents, you won't take care of guests, you won't give in charity. You understand? So it's all these things are underlying principles. That's why one has to see all the way back. If you don't do this, then that means all these other things will happen also. Yes? Oh, okay, yeah, because he was a miser. Yes, yes, yes. Because that's the whole point, is that, like, there's one, yeah, yes, that's a good example. It's a good example, yes. What cannot, but they have to contemplate why it's good. You know, just like you contemplate what's useless about a bad activity, you contemplate what's good or valuable about a good activity. So you should contemplate. If he gives in charity, no money is lost ever by giving in charity. Even if you just give it to an ordinary guy, you'll get back the same amount of money. Not a great investment, but you'll never lose. Charity, nothing's ever lost. But if you give to qualified people, it's always increased. So at least from that, if you're worried, I'll lose money and I won't have as much of my security. No, you're increasing your security by giving in charity. If that's your anxiety, you know, if you're worried that, no, but they'll misuse and this and that, but the point is you gave in charity. You got the benefit. If they misuse it, then they get the fault, not you. Now, if you know that they're going to, then you don't give it to them, but give it somewhere else. But it's give. The point is they have to give in charity. Does that make sense? Because you find that as if they have a charitable mood, then that's when the temples will get the maximum amount. There's this idea that there's limited amounts of money, so if anything they give, it has to come to the temple. But if they're in a charitable mood, then the temple will get. So even if they're giving outside, they'll still give to the temple. Like that. Does that make sense? You know, there's a, just like you find, you know, these life members in that. So they've given us 10,000 rupees or 25,000 rupees of that. But they give lakhs to other charities, non-ISKCON. So the point is that they're just charitably disposed, so they gave us some. But we only impressed them that much. That's why they gave us only that much. And some other organization impresses them more, they give more. So the point is if they're in a charitable mood, then whoever does something nice, they'll give charity to. So if we do something nice, they'll give to the temple. Right? And if we don't, they won't give. But at least they'll be giving. So the point is we should look at it, even if they're giving to someone who's not, you know, in the temple or not in the yatra, but at least they're giving. So that they're giving, there's a possibility if we impress them with our activities, they give to us. Does that make sense? A donating man can give you something. A man who doesn't donate doesn't give you anything either. That's what I'm saying is, as a policy, the element of, as grihasthas, that they must give in charity must be cultivated, whether it's given to the temple or not. Does that make sense? Because if they're giving in charity, then you can, you know, with time, impress them that what we're doing is good and involve them in what we're doing. Does that make sense?
What if we make a rule that every ISKCON member should pay $10 as a membership fee, as a minimum? And
as a minimum, okay. I mean, he could give more if he felt like it. Does he get a better card if he gives more? Are you like a platinum or gold or like that? So it doesn't matter how much you give. You'll stick at the same card. So you won't get any bigger picture, better picture. It won't be black, you know, that no one can read it or, you know, something cool or... I think if you have a system like that, depending on what's the facility, you probably won't have that many people who will give.
Membership fee.
Yeah, I mean, what's the benefit? What do you get by being a member?
Free prasad.
Free prasad. Okay.
Feeling that you are part of something.
But we feel we're part of something without having a membership card. Right, we're part of the mission. And if there's some kind of... But what does that do? It means you're paying money, so is there any legal implications? So if you do something wrong because you have this card, then is now ISKCON legally responsible for you? Because now you're a card-carrying member of the mission. So is there legal implications? You know what I'm saying? It's just like this. Let us say man A out in the street here comes up and bumps his car into man B, okay? And they're you know, local Finnish people, and they both happen to be Lutherans, okay? Which is the standard religion here. Now, is the Lutheran church liable to pay for that because they're Lutherans? No, right? But they're a member of the church. You know what I'm saying? But they're not recognized as, you know, car. But if the priest bumped into somebody, then they would say that the church should pay. You know what I'm saying? So what's the legal implication here? You know what I'm saying? So therefore, you're going to have two kinds of cards. But they'll never be able to figure out the difference, so it won't happen. They can't define the difference because they want to eradicate the lines, because then you take out authority. If you want no authority and no responsibility, so they'll never find anything. So it won't have any meaning that you have this card.
I just remember one, that you will have a right to complain to the higher authority against your local authorities, because there will be a higher system of accepting the judicial system.
So it's basically, if you cab this card, you have the right to be anti-authority.
You have a right to complain to higher authority, and they can send a committee
Oh, because you've paid your $10.
Yeah.
And they'll send a committee.
Yeah.
As if.
All your concerns will be taken very personally by the higher
to the top. Okay. So that means you can complain, you can skip one level of management and go to the higher one. So can a temple president have one of these cards? And he can skip the GBC and go to the EC because he has complained about his GPC? And they'll send a committee and take it personally and do all these different things and deal so nicely? So then what's the meaning? So that means only... So this is a card for the congregation. But the temple devotees and temple managers don't have this right to have this card. Right? Because they can't complain. Because they're automatically the people you complain about. But the point is that then if in their theory if authority has to be kept in check, then that means their authority has to be kept in check by their own definition. You know what I'm saying? It means if it's the highest authority, but that means its principle is on a political rating of authority, but it's the highest. But political authority, that means if the temple president, because he's an authority, that's why he must be kept in check. Because he has authority, he may misuse it. You know, it's not because he's a temple president he'll misuse it. It's because he's an authority. So that means the highest authority could also misuse it.
But there are plenty of them.
Hey, there's less of them than there are temple presidents.
One individual can make a mistake, but if there are many others...
Okay, so then that would mean if all the temple presidents in the area got together and they had a conclusion, then there can't be a mistake because it's a committee. So therefore, then what's above that has to.
So therefore, we don't keep such a committee of temple presidents.
So what's the point? You're not going to get a card anyway, so why bring it up? No, because that's not charity. You're paying for a service. That you're paying for a service. Because the point is by having this card, then you have, you know, the right to be heard. So that's what you're paying for. You know. So it's not a charity. Because if you don't have the card, they're not going to do that for you. Right? Does that make sense? So it's not a charity. It's an administrative thing. That's what I'm saying. Then it goes into varna. It's not ashram. Yes.
There is a saying that it doesn't matter how much you donated. What matters is how much you left for yourself.
Yeah.
From that perspective, let's say there are a donation and appreciation. Let's say I run my own business and I regularly donate some money to the temple. But that money is bigger than, let's say, average donation.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, I don't know, but I might look like a miser in comparison to what I donated from what I had, in comparison to one who donated a smaller amount, but it was more in terms of percentage.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my question is, what's regarding about benefits or first is how to properly appreciate those who benefit, because sometimes I feel confused because I'm appreciated because I donated more, but those who donated less, but probably they donated more. But, yeah.
So that just means that in those circles of whatever the donation elements would be the focal point, then you would just want to see that those who you would say gave more in proportion but less maybe in volume are included in those discussions because they're committed to that process. So if there's something that's dealing with donors or, you know, fundraising or anything like that, then or any facilities, then they should be included. Mm-hmm. Right?
And what about this it is that, let's say, value of, or benefit of the fact that you donated in terms in these, regarding these proportions.
Well, still there is the element, as we saw before, is respect is given in respect to wealth. So someone who has more wealth and is given more is still has a position of more of respect, like that. So that's going to happen anyway. That's natural. But what I'm saying as far as practically getting something done, if you're going to have, if you're going to, let's say, do something where there's a fundraising thing or, you know, some element like that that would include those who have donated, then I would look at, besides those who have given more, because then they can always give, but also those who have given great amount in proportion to what they have, they would be able to give valuable input because they have the right attitude. But as far as the natural thing of respect, still someone who had more, someone who gave more, that's still that element of giving, because then that's a greater amount of sacrifice. But it's not in the opposite. They weren't doing it to just to look good. They could have given more, so it wasn't on that thing that they just did it for a show. You know, so then therefore it's a greater amount. But if they did give more in proportion, then that would be even greater for themselves. But others would just see the amount. Like that. So it's just, does that make sense?
From a Vedic perspective, one who donated, let's say, half, and another one who just quarter from what they said.
Yes, but there's one of the element of respect, and then there's one of how much benefit you get.
Yeah.
So that means the one who gave half is getting more benefit, but the one who gave quarter, and that quarter is greater than that other person's half, they'll probably get more respect. Like that. So that's all. Yes.
Is there also some reflection from the other side that when you are giving the charity to also the oversee who is the taker of this charity, and under this connection you give some quantity or something?
Yeah, of course. It means you're giving the money. So you made the money, so you know the value of the money, so it's in your care, so it's your business to see that it's given to someone competent who will use it properly. If you know they're not competent, you don't give it because they'll waste it. So it's not that, oh, it's given to the temple and, you know, so there, that won't be. You could go and put it in the deity box because then you give it to the deities and then it's there, but you may not give it to them as something for, some particular project because you've known that they either don't use it that way or, or even they try to use it that way, they don't do it very properly. Oh, that's fine. Like that, to give a donation for a specific thing, that's fine. That's one of the rules of Manu comes up, is that if it was given for a specific thing and used for another, you know, without their permission, then that's wrong. Like that. So that's there. Also, that is very specific. It can be. So people give a general donation or they give a specific donation. But the point is they can't give the donation and try to control your life. No. They see what you have and they're satisfied with what you do. They give you the money. You deal with it. They can't come and, you know, if they want something before they would like accounts, then you work that out. And according to that, that's what you get. They can't say, well, I also want this. No, they don't. This element of strings doesn't work, especially for Brahmins, right? You know, you give something to a Shudra, you can do that, but you can't do that to Brahmins, because the problem is Brahmins would rather not have the money than have money with strings attached. Does that make sense? Like that. So that has to be worked out beforehand, because then whatever it is, that's what the contract is. You can't. It's not an opening for control. It's not because I give donation, now I can control the temple. No, it's you give donation, then you're giving a donation to the temple doing what it does. You don't like what the temple does, don't give donation. You want to control the temple, then render service and stuff and become one of the officers of the temple. You know, like that. It means you have to take responsibility. You can't control without responsibility. Does that make sense? Yes.
Do one give or take any karma by giving or receiving donations?
It means if you're taking on behalf of the temple, then no. It's only if it's for yourself, then there'll be.
What about when you give donations?
If you give it to something that, you know, it means like, if you give to something that is not going to use it properly, then that's another thing. You know, if it's known, then you'd be careful about that. Right? Yes. It is meant for all the varnas, but specifically the Brahmins should be the one that are exemplary in it. Because if they do it, then it'll work. Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, the Shudras. Because Kshatriyas, how we consider them as Kshatriyas performing that duty, when are they doing that? When is the time the Kshatriya is a Kshatriya as we would see them? Okay, well, that's when they do their duty, but at what point, at what stage in their life? Grihastha. That means as a brahmachari, they're no different than the Brahmin brahmachari. And when they retire as a vanaprastha, they're no different than the Brahmin. You know what I'm saying? So it's only in that period that they're performing. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that means that everybody, at some point in their life, then has to practice these things. So a Brahmin does it all throughout. The others would do well to do that during their Grihastha life, but if they didn't, then at least they should take it up in Vanaprastha, and they should have practiced it as a Brahmachari, because if you don't do it as a Brahmachari, hard to do it as a Vanaprastha. Right? If you live simply, you lived on the floor, you just ate what the temple arranged, and you survived, you didn't die, right? And then you became a Grihastha, and then you live for, you know, how long there. Then there's the chance that you could go back to that and not die. But if you have no experience, you know, your mother cooked for you, your wife cooked for you, and now it's, you know, you're not sure if the brahmacharis are going to cook for you, then it'll be hard to move into that. So that's the thing, is you can go back to something you're habituated to. That's why brahmachari is not just a few days. It becomes where it's a habit, it's a practice. And so it's a lifestyle that you're living at and you're comfortable with. Then that'll make it easy to live that lifestyle with the extended elements of the Grihastha ashram. And one will be able to then contract that again back into that as a vanaprastha. Does that make sense? It's a dharma for every human being, but if the others don't do it, then it's understood, you know, since when are kings worried about contentment? You know, when are vaishyas worried about? That's why it says a junior person. Junior means below Brahman. You know what I'm saying? Like that. Or junior means by age, junior means by, you know, it's all these different elements. It can also mean junior, meaning there's the dwijas and then junior to that. So all dwijas should be doing it, but it's understood as the Brahman will be quite effective in it. While the others, if they are effective, that's good. And if they're not, it's understood. But they'll, you know, keep at it, and then eventually they'll get it. Does that make sense? You know, so if they don't get it while they're within Grihastha life, they'll get it when they retire from Grihastha life. Does that make sense? Yes.
Yes, Maharaj, I was just thinking that in the Itihasas, all the persons are constantly glorifying each other for their qualities and activities. So when we're receiving a donation, what is the proper way to honor the person? You know, because usually we just try to get things done. Like, thank you very much. Thank you.
At least you said thank you three times, so at least that's better than most, you know. Means the element is there is wealth, but you also have to see what other qualities are there. And so then those are brought out. You know what I'm saying? It's just a matter of being aware of what qualities are there. And then having the ability to mention it. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So that's just, it's just those are the, you know, the formalities of etiquette. They may seem formal, but it has to be done. If you can do it, means it may be difficult to do, you may feel it's unnatural to do, but one should try. And then by that practice, it'll come more easily. Does that make sense? It's natural to do that, but we may feel it's not natural for ourselves. But still, expression, if you don't express it, how does the other person know? Right? Like that. Right? Because you're dealing with, yeah, that's all. Okay, you had something? Huh? Yes. Yes. It means if he doesn't have any money, but he's giving time, he's preaching, so that's the greatest welfare. In other words, welfare must be done for others. So if he doesn't have money, but he's preaching, then that's fine. But if, you know, he gets money and there's something, then he can always give. You know, it's not that he has to give to the temple or something like that, but it might be that there's something comes up or there's something he wants to do or like that, or some devotee wants to give to, or does that make sense? But otherwise, his time is, you know, that's the donatable element.
Can be also some distinction. For example, I was listening sometimes that, I don't know, Shudras can give like the nation their work, Vaishyas,
Yeah. But the shudras, yeah, it could do like that. But taking that the shudra does the work, that's actually part of a tax. But in this case, they could come and, you know, they're a plumber, and so they can come and fix the, you know, the plumbing in the kitchen or something. So that's their donation. Because the point is you'd take money and then hire someone to do that, and so they did it for, so if one's doing full-time service, then that's giving basically full-time donation. You know, so that's why that situation is considered the best. You're not worried about what's tomorrow. You know, if there's temple has food, they'll feed you. Temple doesn't have food, they won't feed you. You know, so all these things are there. So if the temple authorities are sensitive that people are giving their full time, so therefore we don't have much, you know, but whatever we have, we'll share. And if there is some emergency, then the temple will try to take care of it. You know what I'm saying? You know, the temple devotee, his wife has a baby, and she has to go to the hospital for that. And so the temple will try to take care, because he's full time. Not that, oh, that's baby, that's mundane, you take care of it. Where's he going to take care of it from? You know what I'm saying? So they're aware of these things. So that's why also when you keep devotees, you understand that you're taking responsibility. So then there's also the element that the temple will put money aside for emergency. Right? Like that. So that's there. You know. Rupa Goswami mentions 1/4 goes for emergency. And what's amazing is 1/4 is a lot. If you take out a 1/4, it's a lot of money. But at the same time, is what you're left with, the 75%, basically does the same thing that the 100% did. It's very interesting. So it's a very, Rupa Goswami is very expert in understanding where to split it. It really makes, you know, a lot of difference. Does that make sense? Yeah. What are we doing with time? Okay. Okay, rules of good conduct. Keeping his hair, nails, and beard clipped. Subduing his passions by austerities. Wearing white garments and keeping himself pure, he shall always engage in studying the Veda and such acts as are conducive to his welfare, right? So he'll always look proper, right? Hair, nails, beard will be, you know, clipped here means can be shaved or whatever it is. You know, it just means it's to the length that is appropriate for your position, right? And wearing white garments. So you see this white comes from the Vedic. That's the Vedic concept. You can wear colors, but it's the specific thing. White is considered the highest grade because that it signifies purity, right? Right? Wearing white and keeping himself pure. So the white represents pure. like that. So that's why that's the standard for the grihastha. But if he wears for a special occasion or this or that, it's not a problem. But it's the white represents purity. That's why that color is chosen. Right? It's not because it's austere. No, it's because it's pure. Like that. Let him never look at the sun when he sets or rises, is eclipsed or reflected in water or stands in the middle of the sky. Right? So all these will be bad for him. So now we'll see his personal behavior. It's all these things are going to be things that are good for him. By doing them, they're good for him. By not doing them, there's some evil. Right? So if you look at it, never look at the sun when he sets or rises, because when he rises or sets, that red, do you remember the story? I forget what was the personality. But Brahma, one of the bodies, or from somebody there, is the lust. It left, the person has to go somewhere. Right? It's not that things just disappear, but it had to go somewhere. So it went into the red in the sunrise and sunset. Right? So that's why the romantic persons love to sit and watch the sunset. Why? Because it invokes desire. Right? One could say the sunrise, but generally those who are romantic aren't up early enough in the morning to appreciate the sunrise. Right? And it's a little colder. Right? So does that make sense? It's just a practical point. Is eclipsed, right? Because then Rahu, that influence is not considered good. Reflected in water, because then you'll get the full brightness, you'll burn your eyes, or stands in the middle of the sky, you'll burn your eyes. But once he's risen, but when the red of the sky is gone, right? If you see the sun, it's not bad. But generally, the main point is don't look at the sun, right? So this was there, and modern science only figured this out a few years ago, that if you look at the sun, you burn the retina. Here, millions of years ago, Bhrigu Muni is telling the sages, don't look at the sun. Let him not step over a rope to which a calf is tied. Let him not run when it rains, and let him not look at his own image in water. That is the settled rule. All right. Calves, are they known to stand there peacefully? No, they run around. So if you step over the rope, next thing you can have your foot caught in it, and then you're being dragged around by this calf. Not the best for health, right? If you run when it rains, you could fall over, right? A Brahmin has to protect himself, right? You have to protect Brahmins. So if you're a Brahmin, you have to take care of the Brahmin. Like that. Let him not look at his own image in water. Then you get too much involved in, what's this and what's that on that side. Plus, if you look in the image in water, it's always moving. It's not perfect. So you might think that there's some material imperfection and get all mental about that. So, right? Let him pass by a mound of earth, a cow, a deity, a Brahmin, clarified butter, honey, a crossway, and well-known trees, turning his right hand towards them. In other words, you always pass auspicious things with your right side towards them. You know? Does that make sense? That's why in India, the traffic always moves on the left. Because then you pass everybody and everything on the left. So with your right turned towards them. Somehow or another, I don't know where this thing came as the opposite, but yes.
Passing inauspicious.
That you don't worry about.
On the streets.
Huh? But the point is, the super soul's in their heart, so, the soul's pure, so therefore you don't have to worry about it. It's not that if you pass the inauspicious person on the right, then, you'll get all this cooties or something, No, it won't. But the point is you just always walk on the left, and so everything passes you on the right, and then you'll always be in this. But if there is such a thing, you come up, there's a field, there's a cow, you go around the cow on that side, or the deity, the temple. You come out of the temple, it is shorter to go this way around the temple, but you don't, you go around that way. Things like that. So you're conscious of these things. The other ones you just do by habit, that you always walk on that side. Now here it's hard to do that. You have to pass with your left shoulder. So that means just the way it is over here. So, but if you come across these things, then you can be more careful. Yes.
Why do these symbologists, they put
Yeah, that's why it's a waste of time. Right? Because the point is what is an Indologist? Someone who knows something, supposedly knows something about India, their culture, their literature, their habits, something like this. But if you don't practice it, what's the use? So an Indologist, an Egyptologist, you know, these things are it's not very important. The point is you study something to practice it. That's why it's said here. Those who study the scriptures don't practice it, that's not considered as good as someone who practices it. You know what I'm saying? So basically, as far as preaching goes, nobody's ever heard of him anyway, so it's not a big, important field. Does that make sense? Something like the BI, that's known. But Indology, how many seminars have you seen on the Indologists? You never hear of them. So if you want to be dynamic in preaching, why pick that field? Because if you're going to get the PhD in that field anyway, you have to think like them, otherwise you won't get your seat. Then you could say, okay, but once I get the seat, then I can say whatever I want. But if you say whatever you want, then the other academics will reject you and you won't be in any journals, so you won't publish, so you'll perish. And so, therefore, you'll be sidelined anyway. So there's no opportunity to make it real. You know what I'm saying? Unless you get enough of them that get everything, then you wait for the next 30, 40 years till everybody else is dead. And then you have devotees as the Indologist and saying that they survived that 40 years association with the academics and don't think like them and still think like a devotee. Then only then they could turn the tides on that. So within their own department, they could think what they like, but other departments may not accept them. So then you have to take the whole... So the point is if you spent 10 hours a day for 4 years, no, four, five, six, seven, eight, 9 years to go through your undergraduate, postgraduate, and then PhD, 10 hours a day for 10 years, how many academics could you, if you preached to them personally, have made into devotees? Think about it. 10 hours a day for 9 years. You could have probably made a lot of devotees. Sat on campus, done Harinam, talked to the professors, talked to the students, make contacts, go to the professors' homes, deal with them, you know, just deal like this until you'd have much more impact on the, you know, people of the academy than by becoming one yourself. They do, but who reads those books?
In these books they teach children in schools what is Mahabharata, what is Ramayana, what is Indian culture, or what is...
And so those books in the schools are done by those people who are Indologists. It means like that.
They give the information.
They say. So you don't have a school teacher, they themselves just go out and just buy a Mahabharata and then pick out a few chapters and read some and then set some work for the kids. That's not how it works. You sure?
At least here in Europe, you have to stick to the plan.
And how many European devotees are doing Indology? Okay, because that's not the plan in America. So how many Indologists do we have over there? You know what I'm saying? So, and so any of them are specializing in doing curriculum work for the kids in the way of, you know, Mahabharata and Gita, and any of them are doing that. Yeah, it was Vyasadeva and Ganesh.
Yeah, and then I appreciate that this mythology. It's still concocted things. So this is the advancement of the few...
Yeah, and in the process, they themselves aren't hardly involved in any devotional service and don't understand our culture and, you know, oppose it also, like those academics.
But this fits in the new order that we should be seen as and accepted by the society.
So the Dalai Lama is not accepted by the society. Is the Dalai Lama accepted by the society? And these other persons who are working in the Indology department aren't. How do you get in a seat? By just being a nice guy? How do you get a grant? Just by being a nice guy? No. It's called tooth and nail. So therefore, what do you mean? He's a politician, but everybody knows about him. He can walk around in his bald head and robes, and everybody will think, wow, here's the Dalai Lama. Isn't that nice? And we're saying to fit in, we shouldn't be walking around with our bald head and robes. But every Buddhist I've ever seen, except for a lay Buddhist, but every Buddhist monk, doesn't matter where they go, what they're doing, they're wearing their outfit. So now, if I walk down the street dressed like this, where I actually look like I'm wearing a traditional outfit rather than just something put together with your mother's bed sheets, people will think I'm a Buddhist. Nobody thinks I'm a Hare Krishna. I have to tell them I'm a Hare Krishna. Right? Well, previously, when they'd see us, oh, it's Hare Krishna. Even if you were a Buddhist, they would think you were a Hare Krishna. But now, they think we're Buddhists. So that's how much advancement we've made. By their discussions. You know what I'm saying? Point is if you're already an academic, then you work within the field. But if you're not an academic, why would you want to spend the time? Because what can they do? How much direct devotion, how much preaching can they do? They have to spend their time on the campus teaching karmis. And what do they have to teach? They have to teach what the university tells them to teach. Right? Not what we want to teach. You know what I'm saying? Where is that Oxford project?
It will manifest in 50 years.
But right now is Oxford's number two to Cambridge. When they started, Oxford was leading, but now Cambridge is. So they're even with the wrong university. But Cambridge would have accepted them easier than Oxford because it was more progressive. The proof of the pudding's in the eating. Okay, sense control of his wife. Let him not, though mad with desire, approach his wife when her corpses appear, nor let him sleep with her in that same bed. For the wisdom, the energy, the strength, the sight, and the vitality of a man who approaches a woman covered with menstrual secretions utterly perish. If he avoids her while she is in that condition, his wisdom, energy, strength, sight, and vitality will increase. Let him not eat in the company of his wife, nor look at her while she eats, sneezes, yawns, or sits at her ease. A Brahmin who desires energy must not look at a woman who applies collyrium to her eyes, has anointed or uncovered herself, or brings forth a child. So these are the times when he says not to look like that, because these are the times then when the element of sensuality comes out more, or some other aspect like that. Because it's like when they put the cudgel on, the amount of energy, because Cupid works through the eyes. So the amount of energy moving through the eyes when they put on that line, the focus is so great, it's not recommended to see. So one just doesn't watch at these times. I mean, there's plenty of things else to do. One just doesn't watch. Right? Now, that he's not watching her while she eats. He may be sitting with his wife and eating, but he's not watching her eat. Because when men just eat, But women, they taste and this and that and so many things. There's so many emotions and feelings and things going on that you just don't want to get involved like that because it can distract the mind because it's because of the sensual element. Sensuality is the natural state of the woman. It's not the natural state of the man, right? So for the woman, being sensual is normal. But the unfortunate thing is the men will have a tendency, practically in all cases, to translate sensuality as sexuality. But for women, there's a big difference like that. But for men, they don't make that difference. So that's why anything that would be taken as sensual is just avoided. Does that make sense? Huh?
At last somebody understands.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yes?
Brings forth a child means giving birth to a child or the carrying a child? What does it mean in your English?
No, it means in this case, in this presentation, means giving birth to a child. He shouldn't be there when the child is born. After the child is born, he comes in and does the birth rite. You know, but it means if you have the facility, most of the time you don't. After the child's born, but before the umbilical cord is cut, right? Because that time, the ceremony is very short, so it adds like 5 minutes or 10 minutes. But in that time, they found in the modern science is that after the child's born, the special fluid moves through the umbilical cord to the child. That makes them immune to so many different diseases and different things like that. Even to the point where now they ask the mother if they can take that blood. They cut the cord and then if they can collect that blood for using with their, you know, making things. But it hasn't dawned on them at all that if that blood's so good, why isn't it going to the baby? It just never dawned on them, right? Because without the culture that you would have the samskar, that you would wait that 10 minutes. Like that, then it's not.
What is the samskar?
The Medha Yajna. That means being fed with the, I think it's ground barley, you know, barley flour, honey, and ghee, you know, with a gold spoon. And there's some mantras, so it gives special intelligence. It's called Medha Yajna. Yeah, so that's done. So the man is not there, because Shastra says if the man is there, then it reduces his life by half. You know? So giving birth to children, that's, you know, women's stuff. Men don't get involved. Like that. You know, nowadays, you know, I've even had women say, no, but if he's there and understands what it is, then even if it reduces life. These are very warped women, you know? Other ways to find it'll reduce his life doesn't mean it'll make him more sensitive. Find another way to make him more sensitive. Mm-hmm. There's a certain time that the blood flows for 5 or 10 minutes. So that's that time. So when that stops, then that's after that the umbilical cord is cut. Like that. Let him not eat dressed with one garment only. Let him not bathe naked. Let him not void urine on a road, on ashes, or in a cow pen. Nor on plowed land, in water, on an altar of bricks, on a mountain, on the ruins of a temple, nor ever on an anthill. Because right, all these different things. One is not eat dressed in one garment, because eating is like a worship. So worship is always done with two garments, right? The dhoti and the chadar. Right? He can have no shirt, but he has to have dhoti and chadar, even if he ties it around his waist, but there's always two pieces of cloth. Right? So this is a grihastha, right? The brahmachari sannyasi might have one piece of cloth, but the grihastha, because, you know, it's formal. He does everything properly and everything. He has the facility and all that. Like that. Let him not bathe naked. It's not respectful to the water. Like that. Because, how you say, a varuna, you know, it's like, it's uncool, right? But if you're a woman, you can bathe naked. So that doesn't annoy him. So you don't have to worry about that. But men, yes. if the brahmacharis or sannyasis, then if they did, but generally brahmacharis wouldn't, but the sannyasi is one of the things. The sannyasi can go naked, you know, if he's in the forest, right? And then if he comes into the city, then he could either stay naked or wear kopan, like that. So this is specifically also grihastha, because there's a meaning to being naked, right? To a little kid, there's no meaning to being naked. It just means you don't have any clothes on, right? So therefore, because there's a meaning to that, then he doesn't bathe naked. You know, so he'll always wear a gumsha or something. And then void urine on a road, people walk there, on ashes, because it's a place of fire, we respect fire, in a cow pen, because then the cows may step on or be contaminated by it. Plowed land means that you're going to plant on it. If it's unplowed land, you can. You know, in other words, the field is just sitting fallow, you know, weeds are growing, then you can. But if it's been plowed, then you don't, because then somebody's going to come and work there and that, and you've passed urine there, right? In water, because then that's yes?
What age should a boy put on gumsha when he's passing?
Once he gets shy. In other words, the little kids that walk around naked, they don't even notice that they're naked, so you don't worry about it. But once he worries about that he's naked, then from then he always wears something. Okay. In water, because of respect, because water is always used for purification, so it contaminated the water. So unless you have to catch fish, then you don't urinate in water, and we don't need to catch fish, so therefore. On an altar of bricks, right, because that means, you know, where they do yajna. On a mountain, you know, because the mountains are respectful and all that, plus it runs downhill, right? On the ruins of a temple, or ever on an anthill. Because anthill, 2 points. One, you pass urine on an anthill, the ants run out and bite you. Not good, right? The other thing is that the anthills themselves are used in for yajnas. It's one of the rules. When you're doing these bigger yajnas or abhishekas, then you need mud from an anthill. So if you've passed urine on it, then and they collect that for their yajna, not good. Okay? Nor in holes inhabited by living creatures, right? You wouldn't like it if suddenly you opened your front door and in came, you know, gallons and gallons, liters and liters of urine. You know, it just would be not nice. Nor while he walks or stands, right? So one should always be squatting when one passes urine. Nor on reaching the bank of a river, right? Because you just get to the bank and then you pass urine there, it should be farther away. Because at the bank of the river is where people come and bathe and put their clothes down and stuff like that and walk around. So it should be out of the way. Where is this? Nor on top of a mountain, because the top of the mountains also, you use the top of the mountain as one of the things to collect for these big ones, like a horse sacrifice, and that you have to have mud from the top of a mountain. Yes. One, it's uncultured, splatters all over the place, gets your feet, your clothes dirty, and if you pass urine while standing, then semen is lost from the body. Small amount, but that's why you put your thread around the ear. The thread also, there's one is that the thread, the earlobe of someone who's second initiated, then the Ganga is in, so the thread by touching is not becomes pure. By Ayurveda also, there's a nerve there, then it works, and it also reduces that problem.
What about the children? They can voice children, they can stand
up. It's good they learn to not. Problem is the Western toilets aren't designed like that. The Asian ones are, so. You know, what's interesting is that this Western toilet, you know, that we know now as the Western toilet, is actually quite recent. We take it goes back, but I think it's more of a British. Like one devotee was telling me up into the 70s, I think, all public toilets in Italy, they were all what they call the Turkish toilet, which means the flat pan, you know, the Asian things, like that. And he said only later then they became introduced, where they became this, you know, more seen, like that. So it's interesting like that. But whatever, they like it. Never let him void feces or urine facing the wind or a fire or looking towards a Brahmin, the sun, water, or cows, right? Because all these are worthy of respect. So then he may ease himself having covered in the ground with sticks, clods, leaves, grass, and the like, restraining his speech, keeping himself pure, wrapping up his body and covering his head, right? So out of respect for the earth, right, you know, nothing is directly on the earth. Restraining his speech, you don't sit there and talk away and like that, like, you know, guys going to the bathroom sitting there talking away, and you don't do that kind of stuff, because then you don't give proper attention. Let him void feces and urine in the daytime during the north, at night turning towards the south, during the two twilights in the same position as the day. Right, this is in consideration of Kuvera and Yamaraj, right? So wealth and dharma. In the shade or the dark, or in the darkness, a Brahmin may, both by day and night, do it, assuming any position he pleases. Likewise, when his life is in danger. Right? In the shade or the darkness. Like when it's dark, then there's not a, how do you say? In other words, if it's an inside room, you don't worry about the direction. This is all, those rules are for when you're outside, right? Or if, you know, okay, like that. Or if, let's say, you're a shade of a mountain or something, so there isn't any, then you don't have to worry about these things. Especially when the sun is there, like that. In other words, you face the sun, right? Does that make sense? So then, like these kind of things. The intellect of a man who voids urine against the fire, the sun, the moon, in water, against a Brahmin, a cow, or the wind perishes. So, these are the. So now we're seeing a little bit what rules are. So when devotees, you know, don't have any, hardly any rules other than you're supposed to wash, you know, your backside after you use the toilet, you know. And then we're talking about so many rules. Now you've just hit a few of the major rules on that. They haven't even told you how to clean yourself. Like that. You hear how that is. We just say wash with water. They're supposed to wash the anus three times with mud, the genital three times, the feet three times, the hands, you'll do, I think the left hand first, you'll do, forget how many times, but maybe three times, then together so many times, like seven times, then you'll rinse your mouth three times with water. That would be proper. So when it comes to rules, we don't have rules. And so when the devotees talk about this is so many rules, this is smarta, they don't know what they're talking about. Like that. Okay, so we'll stop here. Like that. And then we'll continue after, which I hope. Srila Prabhupada ki. Jai.